We're discussing the Antichrist and the Tribulation and the events just prior to and including the second coming of Jesus Christ. And we've been looking at Revelation chapter 13 and the first beast that comes out of the sea. And I thought you would be interested, before we get into more exposition, to find out what an amillennialist thinks of this episode. And so we're back to Dennis Johnson's commentary on Revelation called Triumph of the Lamb. And on page 188, Johnson writes, "In one sense, this monster is Daniel's fourth beast, as is evident from the fact that both speak arrogant boasts and blasphemies." And he references Daniel 7:8, Daniel 7:11, and Daniel 7:20 with Revelation 13:5 and 6. Now, this is a bad start to get off to for Johnson, because those references in Daniel 7 are not about the beast at all. They're about the little horn that displaces three of the horns that are on the beast. So he's not reading very carefully here. But he continues, "Rome was the expression of the beast that would threaten the churches of Asia Minor and throughout the Mediterranean world in the decades and generations after John received his visions." Well, that is true, and it is true also that the fourth beast of Daniel 7 is Rome. But the beast of Revelation 13 is not an empire. It is a personage who, if he is the same individual as in Daniel 7, as I believe him to be, then he comes from this Roman Empire, which is some kind of revived Roman Empire. Now, I don't want to get into whether it's the European Union or whatever. I'm not bothered. The Bible doesn't tell us that, and so I'm not going to go there. It seems to make sense that he's going to come from an area that was covered by the ancient Roman Empire, probably at its extent at the end of the first century AD when John wrote Revelation. But my point here is to show that Johnson has got his interpretation of Daniel 7 wrong. This is not an empire, this is an individual. In other words, this is the little horn that comes from the fourth beast. It is not the fourth beast of Daniel 7 itself. Then Johnson continues, "In another sense, though, the monster that John now sees is bigger than Rome, as the merging of imagery from all four of Daniel's beasts shows. The beast is given authority to act for 42 months, 13:5. We have seen that this period, 42 months equals 1,260 days, equals 3.5 years, wait for it, symbolizes the whole span of time from Christ's resurrection until the outbreak of intense evil just before his second coming." You wouldn't have guessed that, would you, unless Johnson would have told you. "During this period, the church will be persecuted and protected, witnessing invincibly and yet trampled underfoot, conquered but not destroyed. Therefore, this beast and its persecuting power would outlast the fall of Rome in the 5th century. It continues to find various expressions, some more overt and potent than others, down to our day." And to that we say, go and check out Revelation 13 and read it more carefully. This beast is an individual. Verse 4, verse 5, verse 6, verse 7, verse 8. It is not an empire. And so all reference to the Roman Empire in connection with the identification of the beast of Revelation 13 is circumstantial at best. It doesn't tell us anything about the beast of Revelation 13. Furthermore, did you catch that this is all about the church? And of course, it's all about the church because of the symbolic nature of the whole book. So 42 months, 1,260 days, 3.5 years, and he forgot, but I'll add time, times, and half a time. This is all figurative. It's all symbolic. It's all an allegory for the church age. Well, in fact, Johnson doesn't believe it's the church age, because He believes the church began way back with Abraham. But the time, anyway, from the ascension of Christ all the way through to just prior to the second coming of Christ. Now, you see, taking these numbers as symbolic, the way that he does, he's going to have to reinterpret an awful lot of the book of Revelation, isn't he? And an awful lot of the book of Daniel, for example, Daniel chapter 9. Now, many modern amillennialists, like Johnson and Kim Riddlebarger and others, believe that a time, times and half a time, or 3.5 years, or 42 months, or 1,260 days, as it occurs in the book of Revelation and in Daniel, is, as we've seen, the entire history of the church. And Kim Riddlebarger, for instance, in his exposition of Daniel's 70 weeks in his book A Case for Our Millennialism, goes into some detail to take the first 69.5 weeks literally, even though he misinterprets them. He says that Christ is cut off in the middle of the 70th week, when quite clearly the text says that he is cut off between the 69th and the 70th week. But you see, the problem for people like Riddlebarger and Johnson is, what do you do with the final 3.5 years of the 70th week, if you've said that Christ is cut off in the middle of it? Well, the thing to do, according to Riddlebarger, is to spiritualize it, of course. Here he is, page 156 of A Case for Amillennialism. The final 3.5 years of the 70th week, as interpreted by John, is symbolic of the church on earth during the entire time of its existence. It also is a reference to the tribulation depicted in Daniel. This is a powerful argument in favor of the amillennial interpretation. End quote. And if you can't say something nice about something, then don't say anything at all. We'll just say that if you can take 69.5 of the 70 weeks of Daniel as literal years, and then spiritualize the final half of the final week, there is something really wrong with your interpretation of Scripture. You say, what will it take to get these people to see that God means what he says? It will take the second coming of Christ to do it, or them going to be with Christ. After all, these people have no problem in spiritualizing Jeremiah 31 verses 35 through 37 and Jeremiah 33 verses 14 through 26 and applying it to the church. If they will not pay heed to God's specific wording about his covenant relationship to Israel in those passages, why would you think that they would pay any heed to this kind of language when it pops up in the Bible? They just won't. Their minds are completely controlled by their covenant theology. And it's not surprising that Riddlebarger talks about the covenant of grace in the very context of his remarks about the final 3.5 years of the 70th week being the whole of the span of time from Christ's resurrection to his second coming. Let's turn back to Johnson again just for a little while longer so you can get the idea of how this kind of interpretation goes. This is page 190 and following. Quote, returning to John's vision in Revelation 13, we see that the beast is not only an image-bearer of the dragon, but also an imitation of the lamb. One of the beast's heads is as it had been slain, yet its fatal wound was healed. Verse 3. The parallel between John's vision of the lamb standing as if slain, in 5:6, and the beast's head, which appeared as if slain, is unmistakable. Jesus was slain, yet came to life. Ezesthen 2:8. Now the beast is proclaimed as having received a fatal blow, yet it came to life. Ezesthen 13:14. The counterfeit resurrection of the beast's horn evokes amazement and worship from all who dwell on the earth, 13:3-4, whose names were not inscribed before the world's foundation in the Book of Life, that belongs to the slain lamb, 13:8. This wound, paradoxically lethal and yet healed, is associated by many commentators with rumours that circulated throughout the Roman Empire in the social and political turmoil that followed the mysterious disappearance, in parenthesis, suicide, of the Emperor Nero in AD 68. And then Johnston notes that Nero had been popular among the cities of Asia, and then after a quotation he writes on page 192, "The association of the beast with Nero finds support in Revelation 13, 17 and 18, where John speaks of the number of the beast's name and then invites the intelligent person to calculate the number of the beast, which is the number of a man, namely 666. In calling the beast's number the number of its name and inviting the reader to calculate it, John signalled to first century readers the presence of a kind of ancient code called gematria." And from there, you've guessed it, he's going to say that the Emperor Nero, quote, "whom some Greek speakers called Neron Caesar, a name that, spelled in equivalent Hebrew letters, is calculated to 666, end quote. And so the personage mentioned in Revelation 13, who is called the beast in Revelation 13:18, is the Emperor Nero, who died in AD 68, which is very interesting, considering John wrote the book of Revelation 30 years later, and the book of Revelation is supposedly a prophecy, Revelation 1:3, of things which must shortly take place, Revelation 1:1. But according to Johnson, John is 30 years too late. The individual bearing the gematria 666 is dead already. Therefore, Revelation 13 is not a prophecy of the future, it's actually a symbolical and mystifying vision of the past. Quite why it's couched in such language as this is hard to understand. Why didn't John just say that the beast is Nero? Why did he make it so difficult? Isn't this supposed to be the book of Revelation, not the book of obfuscation? Second, according to these people, the whole of the book of Revelation is written to these seven churches mentioned in chapters 1 through 3, and nearly everything pertains to them as representatives of the church. But these are in Asia Minor. They're Gentile churches, not Jewish churches. And so what on earth is John doing identifying a dead Caesar with the number 666 and getting them to count it in Hebrew, a language which none of them knew? Not surprisingly, you can make 666 out of an awful lot of names in the history of the church, not just the Emperor Nero, and people have done such things. So I think the best thing I can do here is to quote from the commentary by Alan Johnson in the Expositor's Bible Commentary, edited by Frank Gaberline. This is volume 12, page 534. This is Johnson's commentary on Revelation and on this passage. And he says, quote, "In the first place, none of the key words of verse 18, name, number, man, 666, requires the effort to find an emperor or future political dictator with a name whose letters will add up to 666. The sheer disagreement and confusion created through the years by the gematria method should have long ago warned the church that it was on the wrong track. After surveying all the evidence, Ruhl says, quote, it may be said that all the solutions proposed are unsatisfactory, end quote, quoting from Kittel's dictionary. Then Johnson continues, if John was seeking to illumine believers so that they could penetrate the deception of the beast, as well as to contrast the beast and his followers with the lamb and his followers, he has clearly failed. That is, if he intends for us to play the gematria game. How Nero could fit these requirements is, on closer examination, difficult to see. If some Christians of John's time did succumb to Caesar worship, it was due less to their being deceived than to their fear of death. Moreover, several exegetical factors argue strongly for another sense of John's words. End quote. One would think that that would be a sober warning to anybody. But here's Kim Riddlebarger in his book The Man of Sin, Uncovering the Truth About the Antichrist, page 184. Quote, since the number 666 likely refers to Nero, this seems to indicate that Revelation was written during or shortly after Nero's reign, AD 68, and before AD 70. As we have seen, since the number 666 is at least as theological in its significance as it is historical, what is symbolized by this number extends beyond Nero to all state leaders who oppose Christ and his kingdom. While Nero is certainly in the minds of John and his readers through the 666 imagery, Nero's reign of terror does not exhaust the prophecy of Revelation 13. End quote. Now, turning back to Revelation 13 for a little bit of illumination on the commentators, we can see that the whole world marvels and follows the beast. Verse 3. They worship the dragon. Now, the dragon is identified in Revelation chapter 12 and verse 9 as the devil. So these people are worshipping the devil in verse 4. They are saying, who is like the beast? Who is able to make war with him? And in verse 8, we are told all who dwell on the earth will worship him. And just in case you want to confine it, as David Chilton and other commentators have tried to do, to Israel, it says, whose names have not been written in the book of the life of the Lamb, slain from the foundation of the world. It identifies these people as enemies of the saints, and who are of, quote, every tribe, tongue, and nation, all who dwell on the earth, worship him. Verses 7 and 8. And one further thing, you will notice that Johnson uses the term Ezesen, came to life, in Revelation 2:8, in a literal fashion, saying that Jesus was slain yet came to life, meaning he was resurrected. And he uses it in the same way of the beast in 13:14. He talks about a counterfeit resurrection. But when we get to Revelation 20, all of a sudden, came to life, this very same verb does not mean a resurrection. It means the new birth. Folks, you can go that way if you want to, but I prefer a different way. I prefer a much more straightforward handling of these texts. Now, what about this beast then of Revelation 13? I'm not going to go into a detailed examination of him, but it's pretty clear that he arises in connection with the events of Revelation 11 and Revelation 12. And the time periods that are spoken of in these chapters overlap. 42 months, 3.5 years, 1,260 days, time, times, and half a time, 3.5 years. Now, in Revelation chapter 12, you're told a great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a garland of 12 stars. Then, being with child, she cried out in labor and in pain to give birth. Now, Johnson identifies this woman with the church. This is not the church. This is very clearly Israel. The reason that you know that is by comparing what it says in Revelation 12:1 with what it says in Genesis 37:9 and Joseph's dream. This is clearly Israel. Not only that, but what we see here further identifies this as Israel. She's with child. Verse 3, the devil appears in heaven and casts one-third of the stars of heaven. Stars sometimes stand for angels in the Bible, as in Job 38, for example. And threw them to the earth. This is in the end times. And the dragon stood before the woman who was ready to give birth to devour her child as soon as it was born. The child is obviously Christ. Christ comes from Israel. Jesus said salvation is of the Jews in John 4.
she bore a male child who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron. This is clearly Christ, who is in the future to rule all nations with a rod of iron. Psalm 2. And her child was caught up to God and his throne. That's the ascension of Christ after his passion. Then the woman fled into the wilderness, where she has a place prepared by God that they should feed her there for 1,260 days. That's 3.5 years, folks. That just happens to be the same amount of time as the last half of the 70 weeks. And war broke out in heaven. Michael and his angels fought with the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought, but they did not prevail, nor was a place found for them in heaven any longer. So the great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was cast to the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. Notice he's deceiving the whole world there, but according to our millennialists, he's bound by a chain and he can't deceive the nations. Moving on, verse 10. Then I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, Now salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ have come, for the accuser of our brethren, who accused them before our God day and night, has been cast down. Our millennialists believe that this happened at the first coming of Christ. Verse 11, And they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, and they did not love their lives to death. Therefore rejoice, O heaven, and you who dwell in them. Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and the sea, for the devil has come down to you, having great wrath, because he knows that he has a short time. Well, how long does he have? Possibly 1,260 days, as in verse 6. Let's read on. Now when the dragon saw that he had been cast to the earth, he persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child. If the woman is the church, then this is the devil persecuting the church in the whole of the church age. If the woman is Israel, as Genesis 37:9 would tell you it was Israel, then this is the devil persecuting Israel for 1,260 days, verse 6, 3.5 years, which is the great tribulation spoken of by Jesus in Matthew 24. But the woman was given two wings of an eagle. This is assistance to flee, that she might fly into the wilderness. Look at verse 6, so you know for how long she's there, to her place, where she is nourished for a time and times and half a time, 3.5 years, from the presence of the serpent. The serpent's coming after her. So the serpent spewed water out of his mouth, like a flood, after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away by the flood. That's probably literal water, although, of course, symbols are being used here. But the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon had spewed out of his mouth. And the dragon was enraged with the woman, and he went to make war with the rest of her offspring, Israelites, Jews, who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. So these are believing Jews in the tribulation. And that matches what Jesus says in Matthew 24 and Mark 13 about if anyone says to you, here is Christ or there is Christ, do not go. See, these people are believers in Christ. They want to see him. They're expecting his return. Then, chapter 13, verse 1, I stood on the sand of the sea and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea. This is the Antichrist, as we've seen. He's being worshipped by the people on the earth after he has received a deadly wound that was healed. He continues for 42 months, 13:5, which just happens to be the same time period as the woman is protected in the wilderness in 12:14. So for 3.5 years the devil is going to turn his attention specially against Israel. You might want to go back and read Daniel 7, verses 21 through to 25. Then in verse 10 of Revelation 13, you have this kind of strange parenthesis. He who leads into captivity shall go into captivity. He who kills with the sword must be killed with the sword. Here is the patience and the faith of the saints. The saints here is a reference to those who are fleeing persecution in the end times. Verse 11. Then I saw another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb and spoke like a dragon. Again, that's symbolic. He seems less impressive than the first beast, but he speaks with the mouth of the dragon, which is probably saying that he is speaking the words of Satan. Verse 12. He exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence. He's in the presence of the first beast, and causes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast, whose deadly wound was healed. He performs great signs, so that he even makes fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. That's what Elijah did. And in fact, that's what the two witnesses do in Revelation 11. And remember, Jesus speaks about signs and wonders in Matthew 24. And he deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image, there's the image, to the beast, who was wounded by the sword and lived. So here's an image. This could possibly be the abomination of desolation, spoken of by Daniel the prophet, and also warned of by Jesus in Matthew 24:15. He was granted power to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. Now, where is this image going to be set up, do you think? Do you think it's possible that this image is set up in the rebuilt temple? It's at least possible, isn't it? Verse 16. He causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark in their right hand or on their foreheads. It's going to be specific places, in their right hand or on their foreheads. Some people have said this could be a microchip because of what is said next. And that no one may buy or sell except one who has the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. Well, it could be a microchip. It may not be a microchip. All we're told is that it's a mark. Whether there's a microchip in it or not, we're not told. But we can at least imagine that it has some identificatory value, doesn't it? Verse 18, here is wisdom. Let him who has understanding calculate the number of the beast. For it is the number of a man. His number is 666, or 666. And there have been so many attempts to do this that I think we ought to take Alan Johnson's advice and not the advice of Dennis Johnson or Kim Riddlebarger and not try to affix this number to a historical personage. We should say that this is yet in the future, and it will be very clear who this beast is when he comes forth. And you won't have to know any Hebrew gematria in order to do it. Okay, one more text, and that is in the book of Zechariah, chapter 11, and verse 17. Zechariah 11:17. Woe to the worthless shepherd who leaves the flock. A sword shall be against his right arm and against his right eye. His arm shall completely wither, and his right eye shall be totally blinded. Now notice that the beast of Revelation 13 has a deadly wound that is healed, and it is a sword wound. Revelation 13:14. And many expositors have felt that this prophecy in Zechariah 11 is a prophecy of the Antichrist. Now, whoever this worthless shepherd is, he is somebody who is supposed to be a shepherd, but not only leaves the flock, but, verse 16, doesn't care for those who are cut off, which is probably a reference to those that are perishing and need a special attention. He does not seek out the young, nor does he heal the helpless. And the idea here in the Hebrew is those who are shattered or broken.
and therefore in need of having bones set and being bound up, nor will he even bother to feed those that are still standing, that are healthy. He is completely worthless. He is completely contrary to what a shepherd should be. In fact, he's so bad that he will actually tear their hooves off so that he can eat them. He's concerned with eating all of them, not with protecting them at all. And so whoever this personage is, he is not a nice individual to Israel. And so the link in verse 17 to the strike with a sword is possibly a reference to the Antichrist, who of course does a wound by a sword, according to Revelation 13. As David Barron wrote in his commentary on the visions and prophecies of Zechariah, page 417, quote, "Just as the good shepherd, whose part the prophet acted in the first part of the chapter, is in the highest and truest sense none other than the Messiah, so the foolish or wicked shepherd is in the last resort none other than that one who is in every sense his opposite, the personal Antichrist, under whose brief reign all Israel's previous sorrows and sufferings shall reach their climax in the final great tribulation. Even though it may be granted that in the case of the Christ, so of the Antichrist, there have been, so to say, shadowy precursors in whom a certain partial historical fulfillment of the prophecy may be discernible." End quote. So David Barron, who was a Hebrew Christian, is definitely identifying this personage as the Antichrist. Now, there is much more that could be said. We believe that the Antichrist turns against Israel 3.5 years into the tribulation. This is the great tribulation of Matthew 24:21. This is the time of Jacob's trouble, of Jeremiah 30, verse 6. Now, it's not just a tribulation for the Jews. The Jews become the particular objects of the devil's hatred in the last 3.5 years. But before that, the earth has entered a tribulation period. This is signified by the horsemen in Revelation 6 and the distresses that they bring upon all of the earth dwellers, and by the trumpet judgments in the book of Revelation, some of which apparently start before the middle of the 70th week. But enough has been said here to give a pretty good picture of the fact that in the last days, what we're going to have is a removal of the church when the fullness of the Gentiles has been brought in, when the church has been completed by the Holy Spirit. That is what is called the rapture, and that is spoken of in 1 Thessalonians 4, verses 13 through to the end. After the rapture, at some point, perhaps even immediately, the earth enters this 70th week, although of course the 70th week starts only when the prince who shall come, who is the Antichrist, who by the way is the first horseman of Revelation 6 on the white horse, when he institutes a covenant with Israel for 7 years. It appears that this covenant will include the rebuilding of the temple. And so the Jews are happy they've got their temple rebuilt, and even though the world is going through a very torrid time because of the judgments of God upon it, nevertheless, the Jews have their temple. But in the middle of that 7-year period, the Antichrist goes into the temple of God and declares himself to be God. Now, of course, no Jew is going to worship someone who calls himself God, unless it's the returning Christ. And so they reject him. In that rejection, of course, he then starts persecuting them, and this coincides with the casting of Satan out of the heavens by Micah and his angels, as described in Revelation 12. Then we go into the great tribulation, where all of the earth dwellers marvel after the beast, who seems to survive some kind of assassination attempt with a sword, and who revives. And then we have a false prophet who comes along and
points to the beast and tells everyone to worship the beast, doing great signs and wonders in the process. In doing so, he is counteracting the signs and wonders that are being done by the two witnesses in the same time period as spoken of in Revelation 11. These two witnesses, I believe, are Moses and Elijah. And so everyone receives this mark, or the number of the mark, and they worship the beast, who is the little horn of Daniel 7. This worship is only stopped by the second advent of Christ, spoken of in Revelation 19, verse 11, and Matthew 24, verses 27 through 31. Christ comes back, and he vanquishes his enemies. And now we can go on to look at what happens. If you want to know much more on these details, you'll have to take our courses on the book of Revelation and the book of Daniel and the book of Matthew. This is all that I can do at this time.